Your Steve Jones Show podcast is loading now. The Steve Jones Show podcast is sponsored by Sunbury Motors, North 4th Street in Sunbury, and Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
A privilege for me to take care of things on the show while the host is enjoying a well-deserved vacation. Glad you're carving out some time for us as well as we relive and replay some of the top interviews that Steve has had over the past year. Sean Carey here in the Sunbury Motors Studio, Sunbury Motors Ford Lincoln Hyundai in the North 4th Street Auto Plaza, Sunbury, and Sunbury Motors Kia on the Strip, routes 11 and 15 in Seals Grove. A very enjoyable hour for you on tap. We've got Rick Neuheisel from CBS Sports. Be talking college football with Rick. He was originally on with us over the spring, so we'll have that for you. Plus, Ed Henry from Fox News Channel. Ed took about a 10-year project to write his book about Jackie Robinson. Ed with a love, of course, politics and baseball as well when you don't see him on Fox News Channel. So we will learn more about Ed's book if you have not had a chance to read that as of yet. Came out in the spring right about at the time when we marked the anniversary of Jackie Robinson breaking the color barrier. Checking some baseball from today. There are some getaway games. Wednesday business person specials. Bottom of the second inning, Boston is leading Seattle out on the West Coast 1-0. Atlanta and Arizona tied 1-1, bottom of the first. Buccos and Giants, it's 1-0 San Francisco over Pittsburgh as they move to the second inning. Games that have already gone final today, Tampa Bay 5, Baltimore 1, and the Yankees defeated Cincinnati 9-5. The Phillies are trying to avoid a sweep of the hottest team and the best team in the American League, the Houston Astros. Tonight, Aaron Nola will be on the mound for the Phillies. He is 7-6. We'll have warm-up at 6:30, first pitch at 7:05 with Scott and L.A. here on WKOK. Okay, time now for our play-by-play call of the day. A big walk-off last night in Cleveland. The voice of the tribe, Tom Hamilton.
A swing and a drive to deep left center. Away, back, and gone. A game-winning grand slam to left center for Edwin Encarnacion, and a mobbing at home plate. How about that?
Tom Hamilton, WTAM, last night, Cleveland defeating the L.A. Angels 11-7, thanks to that grand slam by Edwin Encarnacion in the bottom half of the 11th inning. Next on the Steve Jones Show, a terrific conversation. We're talking college football and even a little bit of the late, great Joe Paterno as well with this instant classic we had with Steve and from CBS Sports, Rick Neuheisel.
You see him on CBS, you hear him on SiriusXM with Chris Mookie Childers, based on today's show, and that would be a guy that whenever Jack Ham and I kind of knock around a few things before we do a game, we usually talk about maybe some people we hear and that we really respect. Rick Neuheisel's name almost always comes up. Rick, welcome. It is a great pleasure for us to have you on the show today.
It is a privilege to be with you all today, especially given we're talking Penn State. What a great program. What a great year.
A great year indeed. The rebuild to get this back. I remember Bill O'Brien told me back in 13, if he said it to me once, he said it to me maybe 10 times. He said 13 and 14 concerned him because they didn't have enough scholarships to recruit linemen. Were you surprised at all by how quickly this has been able to turn in the direction it's in?
You know, in the aftermath of the Pitt game last year, where Penn State was getting beat badly early in the game, they obviously rebounded and made it a very close game at the conclusion. I was concerned that people would lose patience with Coach Franklin. You know, there are always going to be numbers problems when you go through a depletion of scholarships and have the kind of publicity that unfortunately surrounds the program for a couple of years there. But the way they responded, in particular the overtime win against Minnesota, I think changed things for a long time. And obviously the moves that Coach Franklin made in the offseason, when losing guys like Coach Shoup and Coach Hand, went to get really, really good replacements in there and to build the kind of offense and defense that won a Big Ten championship, I think is remarkable. I mean, the talking heads, myself included, all had it, you know, a race between Ohio State and Michigan. And it was like a horse race where someone just came from behind and absolutely just outran everybody. And the shame of it all, and I think those that had the opportunity to make sure this didn't happen ought to look at themselves in the mirror. The shame of it all is they Penn State wasn't rewarded. They should have clearly been in the Final Four and been the Big Ten representative in the playoffs.
You've been in an interesting position as a coach. You've seen all sorts of scenarios in your career when you did coach. Sometimes when you're trying to build to get there, other times where you're trying to, again, have a veteran football team and maintain and get better from that standpoint. When you're in the position Penn State's in right now, what's the challenge of a coach when you have a lot of returning players and expectations to go with it?
Well, to me, this is a much better situation than he found himself in last year. Given the situation last year and to take the chance, which you know, there's a risk associated when you go and try to change the formula with which you do things and hire a Joe Moorhead to come in and tweak the offense and do things. I had a similar experience at UCLA when I decided what we were doing wasn't working, and we went and tried to incorporate a bunch of the University of Nevada's pistol stuff. I mean, that because there's only so much time you have as a coach to show progress. And if it doesn't turn out as well as you hope, or it has the, you know, the bumps in the road that almost all new things do, you may not make it to the finish line. And I'm you know, first example of such. You know, I didn't make it to the finish line. I think the guys that we recruited and the formula in which we did things proved to be very, very good. And UCLA went on and won a bunch of games in after I left. But for him to make the changes that he made and to get – and have it bear fruit as it did last year, such to the point that he went past, didn't just catch up, but went past Michigan and Ohio State in the Big Ten East, I think is remarkable. So now that he finds himself with all these guys back, the key is to make sure that the leadership on the team, those that are talking in that locker room while he and the other coaches are not there, are as hungry, and making sure that those who are joining forces now with a championship program and, you know, wanting to have all the spoils that come along with championship programs, understand the work that went into it, and are as hungry as they were a year ago when things weren't as fruitful.
Got a couple of big picture questions. One is, you were talking about developing a team. In the off season, it's the strength and conditioning staff that gets 8 hours a week with them, while the coaching staff does not. Should the head coach have more leeway as to how player development in the off season should go, or do they have the right formula now?
It's the only sport we have in college athletics that doesn't allow the coaches to teach the respective sport. And it's a pure product of paranoia. You know, coaches just don't believe that everybody's going to adhere to a rule and so forth. I've said all along, we're all worried about, you know, the how many hits the human body can take. We've got science out there about CTE and so forth, and certainly we should take heed. But kids want to improve at what they do, and we ought to have, I would say, 5 mini camps over the course of the year, spread out over the course of the year. I'd even get rid of spring football and have 5 different weekends weekends or five different three-day periods where you get to go and teach some skill, teach some concepts, teach some team stuff, and continue to build your team and realize that we're all looking forward to an upcoming season. I would tweak that as quickly as I could if I were commissioner for a day.
Under being commissioner for a day, about a third of those who entered the draft early for the NFL did not get picked. What is your opinion on if any rule needs to be tweaked there, if at all?
Well, here again, the one that is losing out has no voice at the table, that being the player.
Right.
Listen, the autonomous five, the power five, asked for autonomy so that they might be able to do more and not be held down because of the purse strings of the group of five. They wanted the ability to do more for the student athlete. Well, this is a perfect opportunity. I'll give you the example of Noah Brown, the wide receiver from Ohio State, who decides he wants to throw in his lot with the NFL. He's given all sorts of good advice or what he believes to be good advice, that he's going to be a high draft choice. He had the big game against Oklahoma and Norman, and he's going to be, you know, he's a great athlete and so forth. But the rule currently allows for only five players from any particular team. Ohio State having had seven draft choices and, you know, the year before having had 12, only five of those guys get to submit paperwork to be completed by the NFL that comes back and gives him a grade as to where he might go. Noah Brown didn't get that paperwork. So he listens to those who tell him he's going to be a top, you know, day one or day two guy, and now he ends up seventh round with the Dallas Cowboys. And, you know, he's going to have his chance, but Noah Brown, if given his druthers, might have said after day two, hey, it didn't turn out like I said, I'd like to go back to Ohio State. I think Urban Meyer would have loved it. People worry about whether or not there'll be enough scholarships. Every coach in the country has a couple scholarships in his back pocket tucked away for a transfer or the like. And if he couldn't go back to Ohio State, at least he could come back to college, just as we have the graduate transfer phenomena going across the country. And he can finish his degree someplace else. To me, we have to look out for the kid. And we can get the agents even further out of this deal. If we just tell kids, don't get an agent, go ahead and get ready for your combine on your respective campuses and keep working out. And then if it doesn't work out, you come back to school and finish your degrees at the same time continuing to develop your skill set, and maybe next year's draft will go much better. I don't understand why we can't do it. It seems pretty common sense to me.
Yep, no, I'm with you on that. You've got complete common sense on both the points that you made. Now, the next part about the draft. Leonard Fournette, Christian McCaffrey did not play in bowl games, ended up going 4-8 respectively. Jake Butt did play in the bowl game, and I thought he was the best tight end of the Big Ten the last 2 years. He got hurt, ended up going on the third day. As someone who analyzes and as someone who coached, how do you feel about the decision about playing in bowl games now?
Well, that genie has left the bottle. You just pointed it out. Just imagine being one of those agents that I talked about, and I don't mean to act as if they're all terrible people. They do a great job, and it's a service and so forth. But sitting in a home of a prospective first-rounder, you mentioned the story of Jake Butt, or go back a year before that, and Jalen Smith, the linebacker from Notre Dame, and all of a sudden you can point out not millions of reasons why that was a poor decision given the magnitude of the game that they played in. It wasn't for a national championship. It wasn't a playoff game. They'll use the terms, it was an exhibition game. Why would you do that? And the fact that the NFL drafted Fournette with the fourth pick and McCaffrey with the eighth pick showed that there was no ill thoughts given towards those two fine student athletes in their attempt to go to the next level. They still believe them to be quality guys. So we're going to see more and more of that, and that's just what's going to happen. So we have to protect ourselves against that as the NCAA game. And the ways to do that are, number one, the best way in my mind is to change the redshirt rule.
Okay.
I think currently right now we allow kids 5 years to complete 4 years of eligibility.
Mm-hmm.
Either change that rule to just 5 years to complete 5 years of eligibility so that everybody's eligible, and now when you get to the end of your season, you still have enough of a roster to make decisions, or guys are going to be playing the same position. You don't feel that that pull that coaches always feel. Should I pull this kid out of his redshirt year, you know, in that late in the season? everybody's eligible and everybody can play. Or if that's too big a step, the next idea I think would be, we currently have a rule that allows kids to play up to 3 games in a year, and if they get hurt, then they can qualify and get their year back. Let mm-hmm. those 3 games be any time during the season, and don't make it be a medical injury that allows them to get their year back. If they play 3 or less games, allow that to be qualified as a redshirt year, and now you'll get quality play. And I think the bowl games, especially those that are considered less important, will be a lot of fun because fans will get to see some kids that maybe otherwise you hadn't seen that year. A freshman quarterback that gets to play because the senior quarterback is afraid of the injuries we just talked about and doesn't want to play. It'll be interesting to see how many kids will do it, but that number will definitely grow.
Interesting answer. You mentioned, you used the term talking heads earlier. You said, I'm now a part of that as well. Okay. So as someone who's been now on, quote, both sides of this, as talking heads, what do we talk too much about that you know from the other side as a coach that we talk too much about, and what don't we talk enough about?
Oh, that's a great question. What do we talk too much about? I don't think we discuss enough the importance of motivation. I think we talk talent discrepancies. We are ad nauseum about, you know, dropping the names that we've become familiar with and so forth. And clearly those kids deserve the notoriety and recognition they get. But in terms of getting a team ready to play and to get them to be at fever pitch, given, you know, that you're doing this 12 times over the course of the year and hopefully beyond, I don't think we understand the challenges that coaches have, not only just head coaches who are going to talk in a locker room, but the assistant coaches, to get guys to the right level and the idea of getting those leaders on the team. Every coach that I know will talk about how important it is to have the locker room the way they want it, and to make sure that those in the locker room who have captured the attention of everybody else are leading in the proper way.
Wow. You in Los Angeles, you could call maybe the cradle of possible NFL quarterbacks Sam Darnold and Zach Rosen, and Tom Bradley's told me enough about Rosen. What do you think about those two heading into this year?
Had Darnold been available this year, he would have been the first guy taken in the draft.
Agreed.
I was at the Rose Bowl. Both he and Trace McSorley put on a show.
Yes.
I don't know if you knew this. I threw 4 touchdown passes in my game, and both of them had 4 touchdown passes in that game up until Darnold threw the 5th. My sons were crushed when it happened, and I was sitting there going, at least I was at the game when they broke it. I mean, it was.
I did mention on the broadcast that he broke it.
He was amazing, and I think he's a lot like Pennsylvania fans will like this name. I think he's Ben Roethlisberger.
Yeah.
But Roethlisberger towards the back half of his career, where he became a pocket presence, he really understands how to throw from the pocket. And like Ben in his early years, when he gets out of the pocket, he's lethal. I mean, he makes plays. I remember coaching for the Baltimore Ravens when Rex Ryan was the defensive coordinator there, and one of his biggest coaching points to the Raven defenders was, don't sack Ben. Keep him in there. We want him throwing from the pocket. He's much less dangerous there than when he gets out. He's like Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. When Robert Redford Gooden hit a bull in the backside with a banjo, and all of a sudden when he said, can I move? That was Roethlisberger. Well, Darnold has both of those attributes, and at a very young age, I think he's really sensational. Rosen, you know, still to be determined. He started his career like a house of fire. That game against Virginia, I thought, was brilliant. I saw his first game last year against Texas A&M where he really took some major hits from Myles Garrett and company. I thought he showed real toughness in that game, but obviously that season got away from him as he got hurt against Arizona State. I think much to still be determined. He does not have the same weapons that he had as a freshman. I don't know what's in the fold from a receiving standpoint this year for UCLA, but he gets a big stage on opening weekend as Texas A&M returns the visit to the Rose Bowl. So hopefully Jed Fish, the new offensive coordinator there at UCLA, can get him untracked. And if that happens, UCLA fans will be thrilled. Fitzgerald. He's got all the talent. We'll wait and see how it materializes in 2017.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for your valuable time. We really appreciate it, Rick.
I appreciate being with you. It's always fun. I thought we were going to talk about Paterno and I doing Wild Thing, but we'll do that next time.
Wait a minute. I can't let you go on that. I mean, I just saw Sue on Sunday night.
Your producer just said, hey, now, we may talk to you about, you know, one of my greatest memories in all my coaching career. I get invited to the Nike trip 1996 in Jamaica, right? I'm this wet-behind-the-ears coach. My wife hasn't even turned 30 years old yet, and we're on our way to Jamaica. And we're walking with our bags by the pool, and all the other guys who had arrived and their wives are all sitting by this pool, and I look over there and I see, you know, the greatest of all time, Joe Paterno. And I look at my wife, I go, that's Joe Paterno. And he looks over and he yells at me, hey, Neuheisel! Neuheisel! And I'm like, he knows who I am. And I go, I put my bags down and I run over there and he says, get me a bourbon! You know? And get yourself one, too! I go over there and I go, what kind, Coach? He goes, the good stuff. Uncle Phil's buying. So I bring the bourbon back over to him. He says, sit down, kid. He says, what are you doing taking your team skiing? I said, what do you mean? Because I had taken my team skiing. He looks at me and says, you're ruining the game. And I said, Coach, I'm sorry. He goes, no, I'm kidding you. And he goes into this, how I'm refreshing. I'm good for the game. The game needs more guys like me. And immediately, he's my hero, right?
Yep.
Later that week, we're on stage. We're having this bingo night, and all of a sudden they give me a guitar and say, "You, as the rookie now, you got to play a song." So I get up there, and I don't, you know, what song to play. It comes to me, I'll do Wild Thing. It's three chords. I can hang with that. And I go, Coach Paterno, will you come up and sing Wild Thing with me? Now, who in the heck in the world would believe that he would say, sure? He comes up on stage. He prefaces everything by telling it is a story of Sister Mary Elizabeth and when he was in eighth grade,
told him to get
in the back of the line, your voice is changing. And then that 7 years later, she did the same thing. You've heard that story a million times, I'm sure.
Joe's told me.
He gets up on stage, and I say, Coach, when I nod, you sing Wild Thing. Just scream it. So we did this, and I wish you could have seen. Now, this is 1996, before we had videos on our phones, but I guarantee you, had we had videos on our phones in that day, every person there would have had that thing up watching Joe Paterno sing Wild Thing. It was one of the great thrills of my life and one of my all-time heroes. I can promise you that.
I know him for 32 years. He never did tell me that story.
Wild Thing!
All of us can do the impersonation in one form or another. Yours is really good. So.
Oh, goodness gracious.
Rick,
you make my heart sing!
Get out of here.
Groovy. Rick, thanks. What's groovy, kid?
And kid. You'd always say kid.
Kid. Now you know his authentic story when I throw the kid in there. Exactly right.
Exactly right. Hey, Rick, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Great to be with you. You take care.
You too. Oh, my goodness. That may have been the single greatest segment we've ever done on this show.
Definitely a classic. Rick Neuheisel from CBS Sports. We'll see him at the desk during halftime and pregame and postgame at the SEC on CBS. And, of course, you can catch him during the week, too, on the Tuesday night shows on CBS Sports Network. Always great to catch Rick and the CBS College Football guys to get you ready for another week of college football. Inside College Football is the show Tuesday nights at 9 on CBS Sports Network with Coach Neuheisel. Best of the Steve Jones Show. Sean Carey here. Sarah Benick will get us caught up with headlines. And then checking in with Steve will be Ed Henry from Fox News Channel. We'll talk about his book about Jackie Robinson next half hour on WKOK. Mm-hmm.
sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
This week we've got the best of the Steve Jones Show, replaying some of his best interviews from over the past year. And while he's enjoying vacation, we'll keep the seat warm in the Sunbury Motors studios. Sunbury Motors, Ford, Lincoln, Hyundai, in the North 4th Street Auto Plaza, Sunbury, and Sunbury Motors Kia on the Strip, Routes 11 and 15 in Sewell's Grove. I'm Sean Carey, Ed Henry, Fox News Channel. Not far away, we'll talk about his book, 42 Faith. Jackie Robinson story, part of the story that you may not be aware of. So we will talk about that with Steve and Ed in just a few moments. But first off, we have our sports bozo of the day. This one just barely makes the cut. It's more kind of a stupid move than a bozo move. Atlanta Falcons wide receiver Julio Jones recently took a tumble off a jet ski. And when he emerged out of the lake, he was missing something. One of his diamond earrings. One of them. With a value of $150,000 had fallen out. So what's Jones do? He hires a dive team to scour a lake in Georgia to recover the lost jewelry. Divers went far down as 65 feet and yesterday came up empty-handed. One of the divers said, "It's down in crevices and nooks and crannies, literally, absolutely impossible to find." And asked whether the earring was worth the $100,000, Julio Jones says, "Yeah, it was worth a little bit." Jones' jeweler said the earring was worth $150,000. Jones has reported to Falcons training camp today. He says he's just glad that no one got hurt when he fell off the jet ski. "As long as I'm good, I'm good. It's materialistic stuff. You can always get that kind of stuff back." Puts it in perspective, but you buy a home for 150 grand, let alone a diamond ring. I know what I would choose. So, earlier this year, a terrific baseball book. Ed Henry took 10 years to work on it. So when we didn't see him on Fox News Channel, on Fox News, he was working on this. The book's called 42 Faith, the rest of the Jackie Robinson story. And here's his conversation with Steve.
Very pleased to bring in now Fox Chief National Correspondent Ed Henry in the role of major big-time baseball fan and not just as the national correspondent. Ed, it's a real privilege. Welcome to the show. It's great to have you with us.
Steve, I've heard your work for a long time. It's an honor to be on with you, the entire Penn State community. And I went to baseball camp when I was a kid in Williamsport, and so I know it's not too far from you. So glad to talk 42 Faith with your whole audience.
It's terrific. In order to do your current job, you have to be well-sourced. And I'll give an example. This morning you were on Fox and Friends, and they were discussing Steve Bannon, Reince Priebus, and Jared Kushner. And you said you cited two sources and then went with the story. What did it take to source out a book that is 70 years in the making?
I mean, it was only 10 years in the making for me, and I'll tell you that story in a moment. But for Jackie, you're right. I mean, this weekend, 70th anniversary of his first game with the Brooklyn Dodgers. I have to say that, you know, the real challenge for me was, A, I have a day job, as you say, and I've had a lot of people saying, why in the world did you do a book about baseball? I mean, look, I'm passionate about it, and I wanted to get away from my day job and do something different rather than, I mean, you wouldn't have me on if I wrote a book about Obamacare, and God, who knows what do I have to say about Obamacare? Everything's been said, right? And I'm not picking sides, positive, negative, everything's been said. I wanted to do something different. I wanted to, you know, build on wonderful books and movies that have already been done about Jackie Robinson and Branch Rickey, and people say, what's new here? I'll tell you what's new. And I just want to build on the awesome legacy that Jackie left behind. And the angle that I took was, you know, about Jackie's faith and Branch Rickey's faith, and how it's my contention that it was sort of the secret sauce here, that you had men of different races, different generations, different regions of the country. Jackie came of age in Pasadena, California, and Branch Rickey born on a farm in Ohio, along
on the Kentucky border. Two much different men. I think what they had in common, they were bound together by this great game of baseball and by a strong faith in God. They both had a strong faith in God. And so in terms of sourcing, a lot of the material I got was out of the Library of Congress. The Robinson family was generous enough to donate to the entire nation Jackie Robinson's personal papers. And I think people have gone through them and kind of looked at, you know, what he had to say in letters and whatnot about baseball, about civil rights, and all of that is very important. I wanted to take the tact of looking at something completely different, and I found some of Jackie's personal writings that haven't really been highlighted much before, if at all, where he got very personal about how faith in God was sort of a critical ingredient for him, of course. I mean, it sort of makes sense, but I just haven't seen a lot of people focus on it, so I sort of dug deep on the idea that to not just deal with the pressure that he faced, but to overcome the pressure, the threats, the taunts, the racial epithets, and the death threats, frankly, all because he wanted to play baseball. A lot of it was leaning on his personal faith in God.
I'll get to his faith in a moment. I want to talk about Branch Rickey because you and I both know the vote was 15-1. Let's not do this. And then they signed him, and at least he started out in the International League with the Montreal Royals, and Montreal was a very accepting city in 1946.
They were, yeah.
So I want to get to then Branch Rickey. Where did faith play a role? Because if I recall in the interviews I've seen about this, you've talked about him talking with his pastor and it opened his eyes.
Yeah, well, I've got two things. I mean, what's new in this book is I learned 10 years ago accidentally that there was a little twist on history and that Branch Rickey had some second thoughts and almost pulled out of the deal in 45, 2 years before Jackie went to the big leagues. As you suggested, it's about his minor league contract with the Montreal Royals. And look, I don't think it makes Branch Rickey any less of a hero that as well. Jackie's the real hero here, but Rickey's a hero as well for sticking his neck out as a white man in 1945 for an African American. That didn't happen very often, to say the least, especially this magnitude. He had some second thoughts, Branch Rickey. I think it makes him more of a hero because it shows that he thought through this very carefully. This was not willy-nilly. He knew this was going to be hard, extremely hard. And so he secretly went to a minister in Brooklyn Heights, a famous church called Plymouth Church, still around today, and was a stop on the Underground Railroad in the 1800s. If you Google it, look it up on your own. And I think it was the scene of yet another important moment in the Civil Rights Movement, because Branch Rickey went behind closed doors with this minister. I won't, I'll save it for 42 Faith so you can check it out, the actual details. But the point is, it shows that at this critical moment, Branch Rickey leaned on his faith, and it shows, secondly, that the narrative in the movie 42 and a lot of the other books that have been written about both of these two great men have been on the, you know, gone with the notion that Branch Rickey was so religious and so moralistic that he was dead certain this was the right thing to do. He never wavered. His nickname was the Mahatma. Another nickname was El Cheapo because of the way he slashed the Brooklyn Dodgers contract. But the Mahatma never wavered. You know, he knew this was the right thing and he was going to do it. Damn the consequences. Well, I think actually it's a little more complicated. And again, that complication makes him more of a hero. Quick other story, going back to his childhood. A lot of people don't know that in the early 1900s, Branch Rickey, long before he was a big executive with the Cardinals and then the Dodgers and finally the Pirates, he wanted to be a big league ball player. He went to his mom on this farm in Ohio and said, I want to do it. And she said, no. And he said, why? And she said, well, because all baseball players do is drink and swear and party, and I don't want you doing that, because they're a Methodist family, like Jackie, by the way, Methodist family as well. And bottom line is, Branch Rickey didn't take no for an answer, or at least not easily, as we could tell later in his life with the integration of baseball. Goes back to his mom the next day and says, all right, I'll make you a deal. So what are you talking about? He says, look, if you let me chase my dream, I promise you, I will never play on Sunday. And she thought about it and said, okay. And so one of the fascinating revelations to me in the book, 42 Faith, is that, you know, Branch Rickey, even when he was a famous executive for the Dodgers, integrating baseball in the 40s, and his parents had passed away. So technically, you know, like a lot of us in our lives, well, I made a promise to my parents, but now they've passed, and I've got my own life. He could have easily gone to Ebbets Field on Sunday, but his grandson, who's still alive, Branch Rickey III, told me he almost never went to the ballpark on Sunday. He remembered feeling badly, his grandfather feeling badly, and telling him, well, I did go to Ebbets Field on a Sunday because it was a war bonds drive, and I thought our nation was at war in World War II, and I should go. But it gives you an idea of the commitment and the faith.
In 42 Faith, you talk about Jackie's faith. He did not wear it on his sleeve.
Correct.
So where, you know, tell us a revelation or two, Ed, that opened the door on his faith.
Well, I mean, his mother, Mally Robinson, is actually the original hero here. Her husband leaves home when Jackie's an infant. He's born on a plantation in Georgia. And this woman, think about an African-American woman around 1920, putting Jackie and four siblings on a train from Cairo, Georgia, to Pasadena, California, all because her half-brother said that California was halfway to heaven. I don't think he meant it necessarily in a faith standpoint, maybe just the balmy weather out there, but she wanted her piece of the American dream. One of the details I found in my reporting that I just could not believe was that Mally Robinson literally had a few dollars sewn into her dress just to make sure she had a few bucks for her kids on that train ride. Think about a train ride. Think about even right now from Georgia to California on a first-class Amtrak car. It'd be okay, but it'd be long and arduous. Think then about what they call the colored cars. You know, how hot, how dank, how dark, how messy and dirty they had to be for this family to go all the way cross-country. So, of course, Jackie goes there, and he's raised by this single mom. Pasadena, he faced all kinds of discrimination. He joins a gang. He has a criminal record. He's about to go the wrong way. It was a Christian minister, Reverend Carl Downs, at the Scott United Methodist Church out there. I visited it among many research stops around the country. And this minister said, you're going to ruin your life. You're going to ruin all this athletic talent. Get back on the right path. And so Jackie not only, you know, makes it to UCLA as a four-letter man, baseball, basketball, football, and track and field, but he wrote in his own autobiography, Jackie, that because of that minister, he'd get pounded on the gridiron on Saturday, UCLA. Some say if he had been a halfback in the NFL, he might have been better than Jim Brown or someone else. He was amazing. Mm-hmm. Saturday, he gets all beat up. Sunday morning, he says he doesn't want to get out of bed. He's all tired, but he gets out of bed. Why? He made a commitment to that minister who changed his life that he was going to teach Sunday school to the next generation at that same church. So here he is. I mean, how many college football stars, not to pick on anyone, Penn State, Florida, Ohio State, you name the school, how many of them get out of bed on Sunday morning after a big game and say, you know, I'm going to go teach Sunday school? I'm not trying to knock them. I'm not trying to be, you know, preacher here, but I'm just saying the level of commitment that Jackie Robinson had. And you fast forward to when he's with the Dodgers, his rookie year, his wonderful wife, Rachel Robinson, is still alive, almost 95 years old. She remembers that rookie year, he'd come home from Ebbets Field. They had a tiny apartment in Midtown Manhattan around Herald Square. And before he went to bed, he'd get down on his hands and knees and pray to God, just like his mother, just like his minister, Carl Downs, taught him way back in Pasadena. I found that a pretty awesome detail, that here's this now famous, you know, breaker of the color barrier, baseball star for the Brooklyn Dodgers, and just like all of us, we're imperfect, he gets down on his hands and knees and prays before bed. And that's pretty awesome, and it shows me, and you'll see in 42 Faith, I got a lot more examples, that faith was something that was really a bond between Branch Rickey and Jackie Robinson.
And he was very poorly treated wherever he went on the road. Philadelphia in particular, I think, is one that would come out right away about that. But you also had to make a decision on this in terms of what words were put into this that you would never in a million years be comfortable with. How important, though, in the end, was it to be realistic to show the hatred?
Yeah, it's a good question, because I wrote in the first draft, just by force of habit and how we behave now, and rightly so, you know, in the original narrative of the book, it was due last August, I repeatedly used, quote-unquote, N-word. I just said N-word, you know, when people, you talk about the Phillies manager, Ben Chapman, who just said vicious, vile stuff about Jackie that we wouldn't repeat on the radio or in private, and thank God for that. And yet, this happened, and my wife and a good friend of mine, as I turned in the manuscript, I mentioned this to them just in passing, and I'm glad I did. And they said, wait, you didn't actually use the words? And I said, well, no. And they said, how could you not? I mean, this is, you're writing history. And again, I'm normally doing daily news. I haven't written something about, you know, like a, obviously a book, but also, you know, historical work like this. And they said, this is the times. This is what it was in 1945. And if you don't actually quote it, you know, rightly and accurately, it's not going to have the full impact of what Jackie really faced. And it was interesting. I sat down for an interview with an African-American journalist at the Wall Street Journal the other day, and we talked about this subject, and he said, look, I'm glad that you actually said the words, because it is history, number one, and number two, the impact is greater. But number three, he said something interesting. He said, it would actually be PC of you to censor it, you know, to not say what was said, because, I, you know, in a twisted way, by by being sort of quote-unquote PC and saying, well, I don't want to use that word. Again, I didn't want to offend anyone, and I don't want to offend anyone. But at the end of the day, if you're going to do history, you've got to say, this is what Jackie overcame. He didn't overcome someone saying the N-word. He overcame someone saying that actual word, not once, not, you know, probably thousands of times, people attacking him. And the death threats he had, I think hats off as well to some of his white teammates, like Ralph Branca and Carl Erskine, who stood up for him early and often. Opening day, April 15th, 1947, there was reports they told the Dodgers before the game, there's going to be a sniper out there at Ebbets Field, out beyond the outfield. He might try to shoot Jackie. In the opening introductions before the game, since it was opening day, Ralph Branca, the big, tall, white pitcher, tall, you know, bigger target, you know, made a show of standing right next to Jackie. One of his brothers after the game said, Ralphie, what were you thinking? And I quote him in the book saying, look, you know, there are worse ways to go than standing up for your teammate. And I thought those simple acts of kindness and bravery, teammates, you know, the brotherhood that was on that Brooklyn Dodgers team, Pee Wee Reese and others who stood up for Jackie. Yeah, they're real heroes as well.
Yeah, Pee Wee Reese walking over, putting his arm around him. Yeah.
Yep.
Finally, just so people know, Easter, Passover, Father's Day, birthday, strongly recommend this book. Strongly recommend it.
I appreciate that. I think if you're a baseball fan, I got a lot on 1951, the shot heard around the world, including a story that Carl Erskine has never told, but he told for this book.
Oh, that's awesome. All right, one quick thing. Three favorite golf courses.
I haven't been to Augusta yet. I got to get there.
I'm with you.
I just played Adios recently, like two or three times down in Florida.
What?
I don't know if you've heard about it.
Yes.
You know it?
Yes. I haven't played it, but I know of it.
Adios is amazing. Dan Marino's a member, and so is Carl Yastrzemski, who I actually met on the golf course. And I'm a Yankees fan, but I got great respect for Yaz and a lot of those Red Sox players. Those are a couple on the list for sure. What about yours?
Oh, me? I'll tell you one I love. Out in Arizona, Ventana Canyon.
Oh, I've been there in Tucson. That's on my list. Tucson.
Oh, yeah. Mountain Course, Ventana Canyon.
Oh, one of the best.
The pro told me when I went out, he said, look, every putt breaks away from the mountain. And I had an obvious right to left, but the mountain was on the left, so I followed his advice.
That's awesome. Yeah, I remember him telling me the very same thing. That part of Arizona is nice because it's not quite as crowded as Phoenix and Scottsdale, although I was just out in Scottsdale with Bud Selig and Jerry Reinsdorf from the White Sox, and we didn't play golf, but we had lunch together, and the baseball stories those guys had. Have me back sometime. We'll tell some stories.
Absolutely. Mountain Shadows, right, out in Scottsdale.
Oh, I got to check that. I haven't played that, but you got to check 42faithbook.com. Yep. It links you to Amazon and BarnesandNoble.com and Christian bookstores all around the country, 42faithbook.com.
Please, everybody, check it out. This book is well worth it. Ed, thanks a lot. You gave us a lot of time today, and I really appreciate it.
I'll do it again. Thanks for having me on. Take care.
Ed Henry, Fox News, chief national correspondent, who wrote the book 42 Faith. It's really a great book. We'll come back on News Radio 1070 WKOK.
Four city blocks of new Ford trucks. Over 40,000 trucks sold. SMC is where you want to be. Sunbury Motors Ford has over 110 new Ford trucks. And during July, they'll include a complimentary accessory package with the purchase of any new F-150. Through July 31st, receive a tonneau cover, molded splash guards, and window deflectors at no additional charge. SMC is where you want to be because they have the largest selection of new Ford trucks in all of central Pennsylvania.
And that means the biggest savings.
Take up to $13,500 off on new F-150s. And SMC has them starting as low as $23,919. Save up to $7,000 on 2017 Ford Escapes. And they're slashed as low as $19,380. Explorers, Edges, and Expeditions have discounts up to $11,000. SMC is where you want to be in July for this mega summer spectacular sale and the complimentary F-150 accessory package. Sunbury Motors in the North 4th Street Auto Plaza, Sunbury.
F-150 accessory package valued at $699. Excludes prior sales and ordered units.